Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, FCC Chairman, former Verizon lawyer and Jeff Sessions staffer, Ajit Pai, has announced his plans to gut net neutrality. So the victory activists fought for, having broadband recognized as a public utility, like the telephone, and not some sort of corporate gift, is in jeopardy. What does this mean for all of us who rely on an open internet, and in particular for communities of color, for whom the web's relatively even playing field is crucial for communication and organizing? We've addressed the issue a number of times on the show. We'll do a backgrounder today on how we got here and what's at stake with two of the leaders of the fight, Craig Aaron, president of Free Press, and Malkia Cyril, executive director of the Center for Media Justice. Also on the show, why can't farmers repair their own John Deere tractors? It sounds like a joke, but it's actually a story about how copyright laws, already problematic, are being used by some corporations to push for a redefinition of what it means to own something. Kyle Weens runs iFixit, an online repair community that demystifies technology. We'll talk to him about what's going on. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look back at recent press. The macho posturing going on between Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un is distressing enough, without flame fanning like that we got from the New York Times on April 24th. Running on no less than 18 speculative verb forms, 5 mays, 8 woulds, and 5 coulds, the piece by David Sanger and William Broad painted a dire picture of a White House forced to deal with the impending doom of North Korea's nuclear weapons. As North Korea speeds its nuclear program, U.S. fears time will run out, is the headline, and the piece starts with a breathless warning about the urgency of dealing with the crisis. It cites, quote, a growing body of expert studies and classified intelligence reports that conclude the country is capable of producing a nuclear bomb every 6 or 7 weeks. That acceleration in pace, impossible to verify until experts get beyond the limited access to North Korean facilities that ended years ago, explains why President Trump and his aides fear they are running out of time. Close quote. As Adam Johnson notes on FAIR.org, the idea that there are elements within the U.S. intelligence community who might actually desire a war, or at least limited airstrikes, and thus might have an interest in presenting conflict as inevitable, is never addressed, in favor of foregrounding the spectacular claim that North Korea is, at present, capable of producing a nuclear bomb every 6 or 7 weeks. Well, that claim spread to a half dozen other outlets within hours. The Times' own Nick Kristof got hold of it, but he turned capable of producing into will soon be churning out. So wait, this incendiary claim comes from whom exactly? An anonymous blob of expert studies and classified intelligence reports, which the reporters qualify in the next sentence as impossible to verify. So an unverified claim. To buck up the case, the Times interviewed a Stanford professor who worked at Los Alamos, Siegfried S. Hecker. But his warning about the threat was in the context of a nuclear accident. At any moment, he says, a live weapon could turn into an accidental nuclear detonation or some other catastrophe. And that's why, Hecker says, the crisis is here now. It's not wrong to worry about nuclear weapons or those weapons in the hands of a relatively poor country with a history of botched missile attempts. But it's genuinely alarming to see the New York Times contributing to a drumbeat that suggests danger is imminent, war is inevitable, and telling the public to accept this on the basis of unverified claims made by anonymous experts and faceless officials. Haven't we been here before? You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If it weren't for an open internet, How much do you think you'd know about Black Lives Matter or No Dapple? If it were up to private corporations to determine which websites you can access and which you can't, based on which ones pay them, what are the odds that you'd be able to keep up with the activist campaign against Wells Fargo or learn how to get involved in the next climate march in your city? There are a number of questions we don't even ask ourselves because it's the internet. But that complacency is inappropriate. If media corporations and their government enablers have their way, the space you rely on for communication, for organizing, for the ability to hear from folks who are not bought and paid for by big business will disappear. FCC Chair and former Verizon lawyer Ajit Pai has declared, in a closed-door event bankrolled by the telecom industry, surprise, surprise, that he plans to eliminate the FCC's legal authority to enforce the net neutrality rules that grassroots activists fought for and won just 2 years ago. It's far from a done deal, but the fight is on. We've talked many times on Counterspin about what net neutrality means, not just for individuals, but for movements, and how the last thing we want to do is leave it to the experts. In February 2015, when the FCC was on the verge of establishing net neutrality, we talked to Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press.
Yeah, this is I'm still pinching myself, but this is the real thing, real net neutrality, the key element in what the FCC is proposing finally, after years and years of advocacy, is doing what's called reclassifying broadband under Title II of the Communications Act. And that's sort of the wonky legal way to talk about the FCC having the authority to protect internet users and actually be able to step in when a big phone or cable company abuses their near monopoly power.
So what is Title II? What is this reclassification from what to what?
Title II is a part of the Communications Act, the laws that govern all of our communications networks. And sort of the whole problem we've had with the FCC that created this net neutrality issue was that back during the Bush administration, they changed how broadband was treated under the law. So instead of treating it as part of what's called Title II, which just means you treat it as a telecommunications service or a two-way communication service, services like the phone that allow me to talk to you and you to talk to me, they treated it more like an information service, which was a set of regulations that applied to things like websites or the LexisNexis searches and things like that. So we had a problem where in an effort to deregulate and really to keep the cable industry from having to share its lines, the FCC sort of threw out the baby with the bathwater and created this big mess around net neutrality. The important thing they're poised to do right now is fix that original problem and actually make sure that the important principles that have always been part of our communication system, always been a part of two-way communications networks, actually carry forward into the internet age.
Well, the argument against reclassification, the industry argument, has been that it would discourage investment. Wheeler seems to be saying that that's just not going to hold water.
Yeah, I think that in the process of this fight, he's realized that those claims are really garbage. And the strongest evidence of that is that when these companies, when they're in Washington, D.C., they love to go and talk to policymakers about how any kind of regulations or responsibilities are going to lead to diminishing investment, you know, even as they're raking in 90% profit margins on cable modems and things like that. But the fact is, when these same companies actually go to Wall Street and actually talk to investors, they're very clear and legally obligated to acknowledge that there is no real anticipated impact on investment. And if anything, having an actual even playing field online is going to benefit the larger economy and obviously certainly our larger democracy and social benefit of having a lot of competing voices and not just whatever Comcast or AT&T decides you should be able to see or watch.
In August of 2014, Ferguson, Missouri, of course, was the headline. The killing of Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, by local police and the issues it raised about racist state violence weren't anything corporate media were interested in. They were forced to attention by social media, where people were not just calling out the corporate press, but talking around them. It may not have felt like the moment was about media, per se, but Malkia Cyril of the Center for Media Justice explained the connection.
The lingo, Black Twitter, isn't about the company at all. It's about the hundreds of black blogs, independent black blogs and black bloggers, websites, individual pundits that use the social media platform to microblog and talk about what they see as the primary issues affecting black communities. And one of the reasons that it's so important is because these journalists, black journalists, have been slowly excluded and marginalized in mainstream media. The numbers of black journalists able to work in mainstream media has decreased over the last 10 years significantly. And what we find is that both these journalists and the community journalists that we're talking about on Twitter have found social media to be an outlet, to be a way to share their work in a way that wasn't able to happen on CNN, MSNBC, or any of the other cable news outlets, because cable is owned by mega corporations and doesn't allow for the kind of independent voice that a more social platform on the internet allows for.
Well, on the one hand, you want to say it's not the technology that's key. I mean, media and other powers could have tried to listen to black people if they were writing on parchment, you know. But at the same time, the technology and the kind of communication that it makes possible is something different, isn't it?
Absolutely. The decentralized nature of the internet allows for a level of democratized voice that we've never seen. I mean, the internet as a platform, as a vehicle for voice in black communities, has become one of the most powerful ways to bypass the exclusionary and discriminatory mainstream media. And because of that, because of its decentralized and democratized nature, black people are very conscious of the need to fight to maintain their online and digital voice.
Well, let's talk about that fight. I mean, we know that for corporate media, this story is going to go away. Every racist act in corporate media is an anecdote. We're told that things raise questions when they might more appropriately be said to answer them. We hear, gosh, this doesn't look like America, when it looks exactly like
True.
America. And Ta-Nehisi
Right.
Coates wrote recently about the politics of changing the subject. You know, let's talk about mm-hmm. black folks killing each other. All of this is why, even when decent coverage happens, it feels like reinventing the wheel, and it points up the need for a sustained space to have a conversation that doesn't just serve as corrective of that dominant narrative and stop there, but moves forward. So what is the state of play on the fight to have the internet be that sort of space?
Well, right now, you know, as the people of Ferguson are on the front lines demanding justice for yet another murder of a young black man unarmed, black people are also on the front lines to maintain the right to speak online about the rampant police brutality in our communities. And one of the front lines that black people are fighting on is the fight for the open internet. Black communities across this country are saying loud and clear that they want to keep the internet open. We understand that the only way that the court in Verizon versus the FCC said very clearly, the only way the Federal Communications Commission can enforce non-discrimination rules online is to reclassify broadband as a Title II common carrier service. Now, let me explain that for a minute, because people say, well, what is Title II? Title II simply means that the internet should be treated as a public utility. It should be regulated like a public utility. Some organizations are concerned that if we regulate the internet as a public utility, it'll kill innovation. But what black communities know very well is two things. One, public utilities, when they are truly public, are secure and reliable. So that's number one. We want a reliable platform for independent voices, and treating it like a utility, regulating it as such, makes it a civil right that we can access publicly. So that's number one. Number two, some organizations and individuals have been concerned that if we treat the internet like a public utility, that a future commission, FCC commission, a future Congress will come along and take that away. And to that, I think black communities are very clear. When we fought against segregation in education, We did not accept anything less than the ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. There were rulings prior to that. There were court cases for more than a decade prior to that victory. What we didn't accept any piecemeal, half-baked legislation. We only took what was morally right and just, and that was an end to segregation in education. And that's what we're talking about right now. Ultimately, reclassifying broadband would ensure no segregation online, that all voices were able to join the public conversation, and that Black voices in particular were able to be raised around issues like police brutality, like the incident in Ferguson. And that's what we're fighting for. Civil rights organizations have long been an advocate for media as a civil rights issue. It's only as media and telecommunications has become so lucrative. It's only as telecommunications companies have used the buyout of our communities as a public relations strategy that these issues have become technocratic, wonky, and separate from the core issues of social justice. What Ferguson shows us, what it showed me, is that, in fact, there is no path to victory, to change, without the visibility and representation that media provides. And that media, as long as that media is owned, operated, and controlled by the largest internet service providers, the largest cable companies, the largest private families, the Black voice is in jeopardy. And if the Black voice is in jeopardy, Black freedom is in jeopardy. And that's what we're fighting for. We're not fighting for some back-end technical, technocratic issue. We're fighting for the cause of Black freedom. We're fighting for the same cause that all the Black newspapers right after slavery were fighting for. We're fighting for an end to any kind of past system, to any kind of system that violates or limits our voice. And that is what we're talking about here today. It's not about media policy. It's about real justice.
You can get more information, for now, online at freepress.net and at centerformediajustice.org. And you can sign the petition to the FCC from the Media Action Grassroots Network at magnet.org. Copyright and farmers don't generally appear in the same story. They do now, thanks to the argument recently reiterated by agricultural machine maker John Deere, that farmers shouldn't be able to independently access the operating software in their tractors, for example, because they don't own that part. They just license it. As our next guest has explained, the line is, quote, "Old MacDonald has a tractor, but he owns a massive barn ornament because the manufacturer holds the rights to the programming that makes it run." Close quote. The ongoing fight highlights not just our increasingly wired world, but the ceaseless encroachments of corporations into physical and intellectual space. Kyle Weens thinks and acts on these issues. He's co-founder and CEO of iFixit, the online repair community and parts retailer. He joins us now by phone from California. Welcome to Counterspin, Kyle Weens.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, John Deere is not alone in this, naturally. What is the core of these companies' argument, and what legal leg are they claiming to stand on?
What's happening is that they want to control everything that happens with the life cycle of the product. With farm equipment in particular, the data that the equipment collects is actually worth a lot of money to John Deere. They're using every means possible to lock down what happens. They want to make sure that if you need to get repaired, you go to the John Deere dealership rather than doing a repair yourself. The way that they're doing that is they're saying, hey, it might be a tractor, but it has a computer in it, and we own the software on the computer, and you have an implied license to operate the software on the tractor, but you don't actually own the software that's on the tractor. And that's the part that I really disagree with them on. I think that if you bought a tractor, it's yours, and you should be able to do what you want with it.
And they're claiming it's a violation of copyright somehow, or at least that was their initial argument. Now they maybe have tweaked that with this licensing agreement with Tiny Print. But a lot of these companies are saying that this is an issue of copyright.
There's a few different ways that they go at it. One is back in 1998, when we updated the Copyright Act and passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA, they put a clause in it that said that it was illegal to circumvent a technological lock. And that was originally designed to prevent people from pirating DVDs. So they put locks or encryption on the DVDs to make it hard for people to copy them. And they said, we want to make it illegal to break that lock. And what's happened since then is the kind of locks that they put on DVDs now are in tractors and in our cell phones and all kinds of other products that we have.
And they have made the argument, haven't they, that somehow locking people out, well, it prevents harms if they try to repair something and they get injured. But then there's also a line that somehow it spurs innovation in technology. Does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. And that's this kind of a bogus claim that they'll make. It really just comes down to monopoly control of the aftermarket. They want to make as much money as they can on service, and they want to make sure that the data is streaming back to them. If you talk to farmers, that's really the nutshell. With the older equipment, farmers are absolutely able to maintain it themselves. It's really only the newer equipment. And these are fairly sophisticated machines. I'm talking tractors with touchscreens. At one point, one of the arguments that John Deere said was that they didn't want people to be able to modify the software in their tractors because they might then use the tractors to pirate Taylor Swift music. And that sounds crazy, but it actually technically might be possible. Like, there's a full-blown computer on the tractor, so you might be able to install BitTorrent or something and do that. But clearly that's not the real reason they're trying to lock down the equipment.
That sounds like a real bank shot. Well, it sounds like Monsanto patenting seeds and then telling farmers they can't save them year to year, you know, because the technology of the seed belongs to Monsanto. It's the sort of thing that you think, well, this is too craven to actually be happening, you know, and yet here it is. And in your work, you make a number of interesting points, one of which is, what about when the company then just decides they don't want to repair that device anymore, or they don't want to make the parts for that anymore?
They can absolutely just decide repair isn't an option anymore. And that's something that we've seen folks like Apple and Samsung do. It's very hard to get the screen on a Samsung phone fixed because Samsung just won't sell repair parts. We see this over and over again where manufacturers will lock down the aftermarket. There's a problem with the iPhone 7 right now. If you break the home button on the iPhone 7, there is no way to fix it because repairing it requires a special calibration machine that only Apple has. And they refuse to sell it to aftermarket repair shops.
It really, as you say, it really is criminalizing repair, which seems like such a strange kind of value to be pushing. But I just would underscore for folks who think, oh, well, yes, it's an irritation. You need to buy a new phone every few years, and they're kind of forcing you into that. But you point out that, well, for one thing, there's an environmental impact to that. You know, it's really a societal level question that we should be thinking about.
Yes, there's a huge amount of raw material that goes into these things. It's really an environmental imperative to figure out how we can make things last as long as possible. You know, repair jobs are green jobs. And any time you can fix a cell phone or keep some device you have working longer, it prevents having to manufacture a new one. So that's a fantastic thing. And fortunately, I mean, this sounds all doom and gloom. These manufacturers are doing all these evil things and everyone's going to start doing it soon. There actually is hope on the horizon. This year, 11 states have introduced right to repair legislation that would require manufacturers to help the farmers and local cell phone repair shops and others stay in business.
It's not insignificant that automakers are prominent here. How do you think that this story relates to, for example, what happened with Volkswagen?
Yes, it's interesting. So before the Volkswagen case came out, I was actually arguing for an exception to the copyright law to be able to do repairs on vehicles. And the Association for the Global Automakers, which included Volkswagen, was at the table across from me negotiating. And they said that the automakers were the only ones that should be trusted to manipulate emission settings on vehicles and that no one else should have access to the software. And then 3 months later, we found out that they'd been manipulating the emissions readings. It's the same thing with TVs. Samsung and LG were caught cheating on energy efficiency ratings in TVs the exact same way that Volkswagen was. When it read that the test code was being played, they had different energy output than the rest of the time. So we have to find a way that the rest of us can inspect and verify. It's okay for manufacturers to make these products. They can certify them, but there needs to be a mechanism for third-party auditors to come in and inspect the source code and for the rest of us to be able to fix it if it breaks.
And finally, I know that, you know, repair is at the core of what you do. And I wonder if you could explain the power of the teardown, because I think that it has not just an immediate value of showing people how things work, things that are often very mysterious, but it sends a kind of a message about, dare I say, consumer empowerment. Can you let us know briefly what the teardown is and how it fits with what we're talking about here?
Sure. Yeah. So I run a company called iFixit, and every time a new gizmo comes out, we get our hands on it however we can. So we'll go to the Apple store and we'll wait in line. We'll fly overseas wherever we have to go to get it, and we take it apart. And we post pictures online of what's inside. So the day the iPhone 7 came out, we got the iPhone, we took it apart, and we showed all the bits and pieces inside, the microphone, the USB connector, and everything that's inside the phone. And we explain how it works. And we do that for two reasons. One is we want it to demystify technology. We want people to understand a little bit of what goes inside and make it so we're not afraid to take apart an iPhone. Because actually, like, if you need to put a new battery in your phone, iPhone, it's actually very easy. That's the first reason. The second reason is that we want to encourage people to buy products that are easy to repair. And so we'll give it a repairability score, and we rate products on how easy or hard they are to fix. So actually right now, it's easier to fix an iPhone than a Samsung S8. So if you're thinking about buying an S8, consider buying an iPhone instead, or possibly something like the Google Pixel that's even easier. People can get engaged with the right to repair legislation that's moving right now. And New York and Massachusetts are two very good places where I think you probably have a lot of listenership where they can get engaged immediately. Things are going to happen in the next month or two that will dictate whether we'll get right to repair passed this year or not.
But the idea is you can do it.
You can, absolutely can.
Well, thank you very much, Kyle Weens of iFixit, for joining us this week on Counterspin. You can find that work online at iFixit.com. Thanks again, Kyle Weens.
Thank you. You can get involved with the Right to Repair movement over at repair.org.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.